This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. Today it's our annual holiday book program. You know, books always make a great gift when you can't figure out what to get somebody, get them a good book. In this hour, we're going to help you find that perfect prose for the science and nature lover on your list, be it a big person or a little person. And this year, we're also going to do something a little bit different. We're going to highlight a couple dozen books chosen by Discover Magazine to be the most influential of all time. So if you'd like to add to your permanent science library or catch up on the classics, perhaps you'll find something here as well. So grab a pencil. These names may be coming pretty quickly, or you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where Charles is writing like crazy during the hour to get these books up there by the end of the program. End of the day, we'll have the list that we come up to over there at sciencefriday.com. You're also welcome to phone us at 1-800-989-8255. 1-800-989-TALK. If you've got a suggestion for a great book that you've read this year and you think everybody else should, please don't be afraid to phone in and give us your call. Philip Manning is a science writer in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. He's a book reviewer for the News and Observer in Raleigh, the San Francisco Chronicle, and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He joins us today from Duke University News Service in Durham. Welcome to the program, Dr. Manning.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you. Hello, Heather Malcolmson is the editor of Science Books and Films. That's a publication of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in Washington. She joins us today from our NPR studios in Washington. Welcome to the program, Ms. Malcolmson.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Corey Powell is the executive editor at Discover Magazine in New York, and he joins us here at our Science Friday studios in New York. Welcome.
Hey, great to be here.
Well, as long as you're here, let me start with your list that you've compiled of the 25 greatest, they're the most influential books, right?
Right. Well, we wrestled over what great means.
Yes.
So, broadly speaking, yes, it is the most influential science books of all time.
And I noticed that 7 out of the top 10 did not occur in the 20th century.
it's strange. When we went back and looked at the list, there's kind of a gulf. There are a whole series of books from the 17th century and earlier, and then there's a whole series of books from the 20th century, and there's actually very little from the 18th and 19th. The reason for that is when we actually went down and wrestled with the meaning of this word greatest, it really produced two kinds of books. It produced books that were what you might call argument books, which is what a lot of the 20th century books are. Scientists who published elsewhere, but who popularized a particular point of view, or people like like Rachel Carson, who were not scientists but had brought scientific issues into the mainstream, and then books that were published at a time when publishing a book was science publishing. That, you know, there were no journals. It was the time before professionalism. And of course, the most, if you're surveying all of time, you know, most of all of time happened
a long time ago.
Yeah.
Give me your top five picks in this category.
Okay, well, it's a little bit of a cheat because the number one is a tie. We put Darwin at number one, both Voyage of the Beagle and Origin of Species. And, I mean, Origin is certainly by far the more significant book in its influence. Voyage is probably the more readable. It's a travelogue of a very interesting kind. Number two is Isaac Newton's Principia, which if you've ever gone through a physics or history of science class, you've certainly heard of it. You've probably never read it. Number three,
Pronounce it.
Well, yeah, Principia is what people call it for short because you don't want to say the whole name.
Right.
Number four is Galileo with Dialogue Concerning the Two Chief World Systems, typically just called Dialogue. Mm-hmm. Number five is Copernicus's book, which is commonly referred to as De Rev, again because people don't feel like saying the whole title. Number six is Aristotle's Physics. Number seven is Vesalius's On the Fabric of the Human Body, which is probably the world's first picture book or scientific picture book. Number eight is Albert Einstein's Relativity. It's a popularization of his theories.
Very readable too, isn't
and
it?
Surprisingly
yes,
readable.
Yes.
Einstein was very concerned that the public should understand his ideas, and you know that came out in a lot of interviews and a lot of humanitarian things he did later on. But he was also, you know, he's very serious about it as a writer as well. And then just to round out the list, number nine, Richard Dawkins' Selfish Gene, getting us sort of well into the 20th century, and number 10, 1, 2, 3 Infinity by George Gamow.
One of the great writers. One of the great science writers.
Gamow, a great writer and just sort of like just a great warm human being. I mean, that, you know, basically the list gets sort of steadily more readable as you move down the down, with the exception of Darwin, who actually is a surprisingly approachable writer. But yeah, Gamow is just you forget that a physicist can be such a warm and funny human being.
Well, speaking of warm and funny, well, maybe not so warm. I'm thinking of Feynman, who also wrote a lot.
Right,
of 20th century,
and the Feynman physics lectures, which are not exactly warm and fuzzy, if you try to read them,
right.
You make the mistake of thinking that because people love them, they're approachable. I mean, they're tough going, but if you are interested in physics, that is the place to start. And if you're not serious about the physics, his two biographies, mm-hmm. which are wonderfully snarky, are a great place to sort of get into the mind of a physicist without wrestling with the actual science.
Right. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Phil Manning, give me your picks for the top science books of this year.
I picked out three sorts of books. They tend to fall into a couple of categories. One is a book that makes a point on some topic that's very relevant today. And there I picked out Tim Flannery's book on The Weathermakers is the title of it. And it's a book about global warming, and it's almost impossible to read that book and not come away believing that global warming has occurred, is occurring, is going to continue to occur.
It's really, like Al Gore's really book. Al Gore's book would be the same kind of read.
Yeah, and of course, Al Gore published a book on the subject, a decade ago anyway, that I also read. But this book, Tim Flannery is an Australian scientist. He's just really good in marshaling the facts and putting things together so that you can see it very clearly. And it makes a very good scientific case for global warming. And there's a couple of books that I was really interested in, that one of which you mentioned earlier, The Language of God by Francis Collins. Because it reminded me of a book that came out a little bit earlier than it came out in October of 2005. It's called Our Inner Ape by a man named Franz Deval, who is a primatologist at Emory University. And these two guys, both of them, are intending to approach how we developed, humans developed this moral code, so to speak. And in The Language of God, Francis Collins is very clear. He says, look, we have this moral code, and we have it because God gave it to us. Franz Deval, on the other hand, who studied chimpanzees for decades and decades and decades and has seen many, many, many examples of chimpanzee altruism, he says basically, and almost in diametric opposed to what Collins said, he says, our culture, our morality, did not come from the pens of philosophers. It did not come from religion. It did not come from culture. It came from the apes. And he believes it, and he makes a very, very strong case for that. The last book that I, another book that I really, really liked this year was a book called The Ghost Map by Stephen Johnson, which is a book that describes how one man, Dr. John Snow, tracked down the source of cholera transmission in London. And what's interesting about the book and the fact that if he hadn't tracked it down, probably wouldn't have London because it would still have these cholera epidemics. But more importantly, it was one man. It was one man that did it. Can you imagine in today's age of science and the collaborative nature of almost everything in science today, one person accomplishing something of this magnitude? It's almost impossible to imagine. If we had a cholera epidemic or something like that, equivalent of a cholera epidemic today, we'd have how many? We'd have 500 people on it within days. You know,
well, look how many people were working on that white powder they were looking for the.
That's right.
You know, there's hundreds of people working.
So
on
it was remarkable what this one man did, essentially acting on his own. And Stephen Johnson makes a wonderful story out of it. It's a beautiful narrative.
Mm-hmm. Corey, what do you suggest? Give me a couple before we go to the break. What do you have on your list?
For this year rather than if you want to break out of all time?
Yeah.
Actually, I agree with some of those choices. You mentioned Michael Pollan's book, which is certainly one of the most enjoyable and readable books that I think also makes an important point. Interesting. There are a lot of interesting juxtapositions. I mentioned the Richard Dawkins book and the Francis Collins book, sort of taking two sides on the relationship between science and God, and a third book, which I think certainly belongs in that group, Daniel Dennett's book, Breaking the Spell, which is an interesting, tangled, sometimes infuriating attempt at really just putting science absolutely like a steamroller in the way of religion, and just saying we need to stop and take a look, take a look at what religion truly is. Whatever you think of his thesis, it's a very provocative book. And on climate, I think Elizabeth Colbert's Field Notes from a Catastrophe certainly ranks up there with Tim Flannery's book.
Mm-hmm. I do, too. I actually reviewed that book as well. So.
Yeah.
And I thought it was quite good.
I'm going to get to Heather when we come back from the break. I want to give her plenty of time. We have just about a minute to go. But I want to ask you, Corey, do you think any book out today is going to make your top 25 list 25 years from now?
25 years from now. 25 years from now. You know, I think it's possible that we're going to look back on this era. I actually think the sort of the science and God debate going on right now is something that we're going to see as something very characteristic of this era. And I think, you know, 25 years from now, when people look back, they are going to look at this, the Dawkins book and the Dennett book and the Collins book, that these were things that really captured a time of intellectual ferment. I think those are the ones probably that would stay on the list.
Such as the Scopes trial did 80 so years ago.
Right, and when you read the Scopes trial, you read it not just because, you know, Inherit the Wind,
right.
You know, as a player, as a movie, it looks very dated now, and yet it's still fascinating as a snapshot of kind of where the intellectual argument was at the time. And I think people will look at these Science and God books the same way, not so much as that's the state of the art of thinking, as that this is a very interesting stage in a debate.
Was there a topic that wasn't covered this year that you think might have been left out?
To me, the most surprising thing, I mean, given where we are as a country, where things are politically, is that there were some very notable climate books, but there really wasn't anybody who wrote a book about energy, about sort of where we are with fossil fuels, about how we break out of this cycle. Nobody really captured it in the way that say Elizabeth Colbert did with climate. And I feel like that's a story waiting to be told. I mean, it's an argument waiting to be made in a really powerful way.
We've had a lot of academic books which we've reviewed on here, but no popular. You're right.
Right.
A ton of those books.
Yeah, tons.
Up, but
I mean,
nothing.
Right. There's an enormous amount of research going on, enormous amount of discussion going on, but nothing that I think is really tapping into. Hitting the public nerve.
Well, there's a new administration. We'll see what happens. We're going to take a break and come back and talk more with Phil Manning, Corey Powell, and bring on Heather Malcolmson. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break, taking your questions and suggestions for books on our book hour for our holiday book list. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, and we're talking this hour about science books. And joining us now is Heather Malcolmson, editor of Science Books and Films for the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Welcome to the program, Heather. Give us your top five, or as many as you'd like to give us.
Oh, sure. Well, as the editor of Science Books and Films, I'm lucky enough to get to look through hundreds of children's science books each year, so it's really a great job. And I've broken my picks up into categories by age. So I have a couple for very young children, say in grades about K to 3, and then a couple for your middle school age children. So I'd have to say that one of my favorite books this year is a book called An Egg is Quiet. And I think when children really start to explore nature, they kind of become fascinated by eggs. They might be one of the first things they come across, you know, out in their backyard or at the zoo or the playground.
The kitchen.
Exactly. And this book, the highlight of it is really the truly amazing and detailed drawings that Sylvia Long has done. Mm-hmm. But aside from the drawings, there's just a great text, and it's really almost lyrical, but it's very educational. And children will learn all kinds of cool and interesting things about eggs, from why they're different shapes, like the seabird egg, which is actually pointed on one end so that when it rolls around in these safe little circles instead of rolling off of a cliff. Or to why they're different colors, usually for camouflage, to different textures, like amphibian eggs are kind of gooey so that they stay moist and safe. So the author and illustrator just do a great job of bringing eggs to life for kids, and I don't think kids will really ever look at an egg the same after seeing this book.
What's the name again? Because now people are interested. They're going to write it down.
Sure. It's called An Egg is Quiet.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right. And I guess my next pick here is a subject that's very exciting to young kids, and that's dinosaurs. And there's a great book called Boy, Were We Wrong About Dinosaurs. And just the title, I think, will make kids want to pick it up and read it. Mm-hmm. And it really corrects all kinds of misconceptions and misinformation that kids may have picked up on over the years related to dinosaurs. and it's full of just really cool illustrations, which are very important to children's science books. And the tone the author takes is just kind of humorous. Mm-hmm. One of the things I learned in it, for example, the author tells how researchers, when they were unearthing these remains of an iguanodon dinosaur, they placed these rhino-like horn bones on the nose of the iguanodon. But years and years later, when the full skeletal fossil was unearthed, they actually realized that these horn-like bones belonged on the front limbs of the dinosaur. So there's all kinds of neat stories in the book like that.
That reminds me of the brontosaurus at the Museum of Natural History here, where the head was wrong. Those.
Right, right. And that's just to kids, I think, that really catches their attention and just makes them think about... you know, about the book and dinosaurs in general. So it's just a cool book.
Does it mention that the Flintstones is not real? They were dinosaurs living with people?
No, it doesn't. I don't think it touches on that subject. Maybe in the sequel. I'm not sure.
And for older kids, what have you got for older kids?
For older kids, I've got two great books. One is called Team Moon, How 400,000 People Landed Apollo 11 on the Moon. And this book takes readers kind of behind the scenes of the mission that first placed us on the moon. And it tells the story of all the non-astronauts that made the mission possible, from the seamstress who sewed the high-tech uniforms to the engineers who created all those amazing heat shields for reentry. And it just really tells the stories that, you know, you usually don't hear about.
Hmm. I want to read that one.
Yeah, it's really great.
Am I allowed to read that?
Certainly. I can send a copy over for you. And it's got great photographs in it, which are important for children's science books, you know, because they really, it's just a whole nother layer to the book.
Mm-hmm. Are there any trends in kids' science books this year? I mean, you see more of the other.
Well,
is there any environmental books? We're talking about global warming. Are there any books like that, perhaps, about the environment? Or
there's always quite a few books on the environment. Maybe not so much global warming, but a lot of nature books, and they might have chapters that kind of touch on that. But it depends on the age level too, because for very young, usually that's a topic that's not really touched on.
Animal books are always popular.
I do. Actually, you read my mind. My last the last book on my list is called ER Vets. It's Life in an Animal Emergency Room. And, you know, what child hasn't said at some point in their life, you know, I want to be a veterinarian? I know I did. So this book is really for those kids who, you know, dream of being a veterinarian and helping out animals. And it just goes behind the scenes again to an animal hospital in Colorado, and it has all these great pictures, and it shows, you know, not just cats and dogs, but there's a great story of a snake named Lucy who gets some treatment, and a horse, and it's just a really neat book, and I don't think it'll spend much time on the shelf. I think kids will really be picking up that one a lot.
I must have a kid's mind. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Achman in Florence, South Carolina. Hi, Ahmed.
Yes, how are you doing, guys?
How are you? Go ahead.
Excellent. You, NPR, driving me crazy here, guys, driving this truck. Anyway, I would like to participate.
Well, pull over before you,
I'm parked somewhere here.
All right, good.
And I get to park so many times during the day to talk to you guys, and I do not go through most of the time. Anyway, there is a book, I do not really have it as a book, it's online. It's you can Google it. You can read it also for free. It's an unbelievable book called The Bible, the Quran, and Science, written by a French, I think a scientist named Maurice Boucaï or Boucaille, something like this. And it talks about from the Big Bang, the expansion of the universe, the production of milk, and for example, cows or goats or whatever, to the iron, the metal iron, the element iron, how it came to existence. It is, it's so a major of talking into this book that it's so amazing. I was fascinated by science since I was a child, but I did not really have the opportunity much to write anything about it, or I did not believe in, well, it's stupid to say that, to take it through school. I believe in it through experiments, or to work with somebody into science who can guide or mentor somebody much more than just sitting in a classroom and taking it. So reading this book it's just I suggested to too many people, and you yourself in this show, if you go ahead and read this, you're going to have topic to talk for the next 2 or 3 years about it.
All right. Well, now you told everybody about it, so everybody's going to go read it. Thanks for calling, Ahmed.
Well, and there is another website also talking about almost the same topics called beconvinced.com. And thank you so much. Have a good weekend, guys.
Have a good holiday. 1-800-989-8255. Heather, are there any books for kids out there that gets into evolution and you know, the controversies that are going on now?
There's always a couple books each year on evolution. It can be kind of a difficult subject to do in a children's science book because generally, you know, children's science books take a real general look at things, and it's hard to talk mm-hmm. about evolution without kind of promoting misconceptions. I mean, if a book talks about evolution and it uses the words like need or try or want, you know, it's really promoting a misconception that evolution is goal-directed or driven by a need. So it's kind of hard to kind of bring that subject down to the level of young children. So. Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. Phil Manning, let's say you want to brush up on the science behind some of today's hot topics, hot button issues that we've been talking about, global warming, stem cell research, or evolution. Are there any books that do a good job of laying out the science behind these issues?
Indeed, there are. In fact, there's so many good ones, it's really hard to figure out where to start. But two that I'm very familiar with and I highly recommend. One of them is called Mendel in the Kitchen, and it's a scientist's view of genetically modified foods. It's written by two women, one of Nancy Marie Brown, who's a science writer, and Nina Fedorov, who's a professor at Penn State University. And it explains, it makes the case, you know, Prince Charles, I think it was, or somebody like Prince Charles anyway, said that, you know, they labeled these foods, they labeled them Frankenfoods, and that label really stuck, and it really set back the work on genetically modified foods quite a bit. But there are some real opportunities out there to help, for scientists to help feed mankind and to feed them in a better way. This idea of golden rice, which is a genetically modified rice that provides a precursor for vitamins for children in countries where they eat a lot of rice and many of them go blind because of vitamin deficiencies. This mm-hmm. could fix that. And so she argues in the book very forcefully and very cleverly, I think, that the restrictions, the many, many restrictions on genetically modified food should be at least, if not removed, and at least modified and to make them a little bit less stringent. The other book I along the same lines is called The Proteus Effect. This one, I think, is a much more hotter topic than that, which is about stem cells and their promise for medicine. And they explain very clearly in here what stem cells are, why they should work, why we should be funding stem cell research and take a few nice shots at our current administration for not doing that.
1-800-989-8255. Sarah in Wichita. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hi.
Go ahead. Sure, you're on.
Oh, okay.
Well, your turn.
I'm actually an English major. I'm not what I would consider a science person. But I have had a couple of books that have made an impact on me personally. One is A Brief History of Time by Stephen Hawking, because it's just so easy to read, and it kind of lays out these concepts which I thought were beyond me in a way that I could actually understand them and grasp them.
You could read that book, huh?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I thought more people had that on their coffee tables who never read it, but had it on the
really?
Coffee.
It's supposed to be the most unread
really
book in history.
Okay, well, more power to you, as we used to say, if you could get through that.
Well, I thought it was fascinating.
Good.
And the other book that I had a big impact on me, this is what I read when I was in high school, and it was old when I was in high school, but Silent Spring, mm-hmm. Actually, I found to be very interesting. And just the actual historical impact that book had made, I thought was very interesting.
Corey, I would have had that in your list, Silent Spring.
Yeah, it is in our top 25.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think I mentioned that as sort of one of the examples of, you know, sort of the, you know, the modern sort of argument style books that you know, in some ways it's actually closer to the, you know, the old kind of, you know, 15th, 16th century style of publishing, where, you know, Rachel Carson was not not a sort of a well known academic, but mm-hmm. sort of brought her, you know, brought out her argument fully formed in her book and had an enormous impact.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and. And how long ago did you read that? Did you read it when it first came out, Sarah?
Oh, no. I'm actually 26. I read it in high school in the 90s. And I mean, my high school science professor, teacher, actually recommended it to her students, and I went ahead and picked it up and read it, and I was just blown away. You know, even, I don't know, this would have been, what, 4 years later. I just found it very interesting.
Yeah. All right. Well, you're wise beyond your years, Sarah. Thank you. Have a good holiday.
Thank you.
But that just it goes to what we were saying before, that there really are no seminal books like that one.
I want to find out how she understood all of A Brief History of Time. Because I talked to one of Stephen Hawking's colleagues, and I ran him at a cocktail party, and there was a part of the book that made no sense to me. And he's a cosmologist named Andre Linde. And I said to him, like, can you explain this part where he talks about how there's no beginning of time, but you go into, you know, into imaginary time that folds in on itself? Because that makes no sense to me. And Linde, who's this very sort of, is this kind of gloomy Russian thing, he pauses. He says, it makes no sense. That is why you do not think it makes any sense. Nobody understands that.
I had exactly the same experience, Carl. Well, Phil Manning.
A lot of people did. We're talking about science books this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Phil, do you think there are a lot of books like that out? Maybe Stephen Wolfram's book, you know, about the road
to reality. Tomb.
Yeah, I mean, this huge book that was very hard to get through.
It's almost impossible to get through. It's over 800 pages long.
Right.
And the first 400 pages are devoted to giving you the mathematics that you will need to understand the next 400 pages. And I'm talking about vector calculus and things like this. It actually makes a Brief History of Time look pretty readable. It's very difficult. What I've actually found in talking with a lot of people, we have a big science book club down here, is that the people that know that are more interested in science but don't have technical backgrounds, that's the kind of books that they're interested in. The Brief History of Science. They want to read that kind of book. They want to read about multiple universes and brains and string theory and things of that nature that those of us that have technical backgrounds are kind of leery of.
It's interesting
to see.
Well, on the periphery, do you get into reviewing science fiction books at all that you might suggest? Or Corey, anyone come to mind? Or Heather, you have any? I guess that would be in the fiction section.
Well, I have to say, when Heather was talking about books for children, I mean, I think the science books, when I think back of the books that influenced me most growing up, I remember the fiction books that dealt with science at least as much as I do the actual science books. A book called The Enormous Egg by a writer named Oliver Butterworth, which is written, I think, late 60s or maybe very early 70s. And it deals with remarkably sophisticated ideas about evolution and the connection between birds and dinosaurs, but does it in the form of a complete fantasy story of a chicken that lays a dinosaur egg, and then a child raises it and learns all this, learns about the connections between birds and dinosaurs. It's a beautiful book.
Any classic books on your list for kids, or any kids books on the top 25?
That word "great" is such a loaded word that it steered us away from children's books. But honestly, the problem of writing a popular book for children is even more acute than writing a persuasive book for adults, which I think is probably actually why they're not on the list. Most of those books tend to be somewhat ephemeral.
I remember my Danny Dunn books and his flying
machines. How
about
some of the George Gamow books?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, there is one book actually that I think might be appropriate for children, which is Roy Chapman Andrews, who is one of the great dinosaur hunters, and he's one of the 10 or 20 or 100 people who claim to be the model for Indiana Jones. But he wrote these wonderful swashbuckling adventures of driving in Mongolia looking for dinosaur bones, and they're beautiful, exciting books, and I read them as a kid, and I still remember them vividly.
Yeah, and they're still relevant today. I want to thank all of you for taking time to talk with us. Time goes by so fast. As I say, we'll have these books on the list. Charles will have them up by the end of the day in case you didn't get them down and you want to re-review them. Phil Manning is science writer in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and book reviewer for the News and Observer in Raleigh, the San Francisco Chronicle, and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Busy guy. Thanks for taking time for us today, Phil. Heather Malcolmson, you're welcome, is editor of Science Books and Films, a publication of the AAAS in Washington, and Corey Powell is executive editor at Discover Magazine here in New York. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk about viewing the night sky. Wintertime is a great time to get out and look at the stars. There's going to be a full eclipse, a total eclipse of the moon coming up this winter. Joe Rao is going to be here back with us to talk about what to see in the night sky. Don't go away. We'll be right back also with some advice on how to buy your first telescope. It could be daunting, you know. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.